those, what I mean by these terms, race, forms of knowledge, technique, identity, place, will be more clear, or clear, yeah, that there will, yeah, what I mean by them will be more clear, and you'll have a sense of how you might or might not want to situate yourself in relation to those or go through some of those same pathways. I'm not going to talk about what is artistic research or artistic research versus practice research, because that, I think, is probably more of the background knowledge. But I am going to start from this question of what planet we are living on. Because I think kind of overall what I'm looking to do is situate artistic research and practice research, which for me are basically synonyms, in this context, as contributions to this kind of possible perspective of the planet, of the planetary. And I mean the planetary as replacing some of the ways that we might by default think about the what planet we live on. So if we say what planet do we live on, you might picture the one of the famous like Earth photos, like the photo from the moon or any of these kind of icons that we now have of the Earth. But equally or more so, probably what comes to mind is the map, the kind of dominant hegemonic map of the planet, which is very organized by nations and nation states. You know, it marks countries, and we picture a certain, it has a certain orientation of north-south, and countries are marked out as if that's the main story of what planet we live on. But actually the story of the planet as being made up of nation states, which then have a kind of relationship which can be called international, is not necessarily the story of the planet that I think we can work from. Similarly, the global, which is sometimes thought to replace or kind of follow on the international, is often understood also in a very corporate, capitalist, neoliberal, extractive, colonial sense. So I'm looking to the planetary. Many people are looking to the planetary as a possibility that hasn't yet been articulated. This is an image of Jupiter, actually, which I have on my desktop because I find it really evocative in how much we need to change our understanding of the planet that we live on. So it's kind of like, it almost looks like Earth because of the coloring, but it's definitely not Earth. And that's sort of where I want to start. Like, we're looking for some perspective in relation to the planetary that is going to have the same, you know, it's, there's certain things that are going to be familiar, but it's definitely not going to be the map that we are used to. So I'm going to try to introduce a little bit first what I mean by the planetary, and that's going to lead to what I mean by race, because those are very related to each other in my perspective. We can't really think the planetary without thinking race. It might seem at that part that we're not necessarily talking about artistic research yet, but we will get to artistic research, and I will definitely try to propose some concrete tools, like conceptual tools, and then maybe also practical tools, by which we could try to position or reposition artistic research, practice research, in what then becomes this other story of the planet that we live on. So, in order to do that, I will start with this very intense story, which is a kind of a planetary story, or it's a story that's happening on a global scale, you would say, which is the current genocide happening in Palestine. But I'm going to ask, like, how we approach that story, because we could immediately apply what I was just saying about the international and the global and the planetary to that event, to that ongoing event, by saying, oh well, what happens if we frame it as international? Right? Then we get two kind of, we have like a country and something that is almost a country but not quite, or some people recognize it as a country, and these are against each other in what would then be framed as a war. And then there's other countries like, oh, we're in a different country, the UK, and so, you know, or the US, and so like our relation is already structured in a very particular way. Those are those two countries, they have an international relation, we have a different international relation, and already the whole story is configured in a certain way. Global, you know, would give us a different perspective. But the real question is, like, what perspective are we developing around this? So I'm not going to try to tell the planetary story of what's happening there, but I want to evoke a certain moment in that, which is actually October 7th. This is Palestinians breaking through the border fence at Erez on October 7th. And I think I want to say two things about this image that remains very important for me. One of the things is that, well, it's really one thing. It's really one thing that has kind of two steps. The first step is, like, when you see this fence, where do you feel you are in relation to this fence? Which side, really, of this fence do you feel you are on? Which will have to do kind of with how you identify and assumptions that you make about the world. And, you know, also, of course, where your family and the people that you care about and your kin are located. You might physically be on this side of the fence, but feel yourself to be partly on the other side of the fence. You know, how you think about this fence is already your planetary story, because this is somewhere that's very far away physically, but very connected through military arms and economics and political logics. And so in dealing with that, you are kind of required to have some kind of stance on the planetary situation, whether it's international or, you know, if thinking about different forms of, like, peace, or, you know, how you might imagine peace on a planetary scale, how you imagine colonialism, coloniality, decoloniality is going to immediately kind of be present, but not necessarily articulated in how you respond to this image and where you might see yourself in this image. But the other half of that is that this fence is part of a much larger fence. And I don't mean only the fence that is constructed around Gaza by the state of Israel, but I actually mean a kind of what's might be framed as a global fence. And this, you know, is just one map, and I think I'm not in the social sciences, so I'm not particularly offering this as very precise. Like, you might say, oh no, this fence doesn't go there, and, you know, we don't see, like, we don't see Russia or China on this map, so maybe that needs to be complicated, I don't know. But I want to offer the question of the fence, the what's called up there, the global war, wall, sorry, oops, the global wall, inside of which is 14% of the population with 73% of the resources. Again, I'm not responsible here, not taking responsibility here for the methodology by which the numbers are generated, the quantification, like, I don't know what 73% of the resources means. Does that mean what's hoarded? Does it mean what's extracted? I don't really know how that's calculated. But I think the question about the idea that there is some form of apartheid being enacted gradually on a planetary scale is part of the planetary story, which you don't get if you have the international story. Because in the international map, you see all the countries as if on the same playing field, right? You see the US and the UK and Israel and China and all of the countries in Africa, which is massively larger than this kind of map shows, as if they are kind of equal, right? As if they would meet in a United Nations type space. And you don't see where the hard borders are. And you don't see, for example, there's a wonderful iteration of mapping that shows where you select what your passport is, and it shows you which aspects of the globe you can go to without a visa. And of course, you know, if you put US or UK, much of the planet is just green. Like, you can just go there, you don't need a visa, you're just like, I would like to go, blah, blah, I will just go there for research, for business, for vacation. But then if you put a country that is outside of this wall, you suddenly, whoosh, like, you actually can only go to a few countries, and the whole globe, the global, is collapsed. This wall is a wall about people, primarily. It's certainly not about materials, because extractive relations of, for example, the most obviously the material, some of the metals that are necessary for our phones and devices are coming from outside of this wall and being brought into the wall, while the people who are living in those places and including the people who are extracting those metals from the earth, are absolutely not allowed to come into the wall, and that is what the wall is for. So the wall is to allow material extraction and other kinds of extraction while blocking the people. Just to, this is maybe a side point, I don't think so, but just to underscore the point that I made, that the fence around Gaza is very similar to, it is part of a larger fence. The part of the world that is outside the fence as portrayed here is broadly contiguous with the part of the world that recognizes the state of Palestine. So if we're asking, like, what is going on in Palestine, why is it so much at stake there? It's because that wall is the most violent bit of a wall that is actually planetary in scope. So that is, I think, not like the story of the planetary, but some aspects of things that are happening on a planetary scale, which are not well represented in most modelings that we might encounter of what planet we live on. Now I will just touch on a few theoretical sources which may go to this question of, like, what is critical race theory, I would probably reframe as, like, so how do we orient ourselves to this planetary story? If these kinds of things are happening on a planetary scale, and if the international and the global are inadequate to position ourselves in relation to them, then how might we kind of rethink what our relationship is? So I'll mention three quotes, which are also three sources that can be of use. I'm just going to start with this very interesting idea that I've encountered relatively recently, and this is from a book by Ariella Azoulay, which is The Right Not to Be Complicit, which she kind of puts forward as a right which people who are perhaps inside the fence might become quite militant about. And I think I've certainly encountered a lot of conversation around complicity. I've encountered a lot of, you know, feelings of guilt and shame and also frustration and also anger and activism around complicity. And I also, as Azoulay discusses at length, rights can be a problematic framework. But still, I think the juxtaposition of right with this, which I have not heard before, that to not be complicit in something like a genocide or even the building of a planetary wall would be a right that someone would claim. The idea that one is in some sense violated by being forced to be complicit with these processes is something that to me gives a kind of a new activation, a renewal of activation for any kind of position that is complicit or deeply implicated. When it comes to race, I mean, there's a lot of context that we could use. I will just start with this, I mean, touching lightly on theory, and it's something we can dive much more into. Bodies are shaped by histories of colonialism, and I didn't maybe make this completely explicit, but the maps that we were just looking at are kind of maps of contemporary colonialism that are contiguous with European colonialism over 500, 600 years. Bodies are shaped by histories of colonialism, which make the world white, a world that is inherited or which is already given before the point of an individual's arrival. So I think probably the key point for the question of, like, what is race and what is critical race studies, is that while we are talking about bodies, it's not only bodies that are white, but it's the world that is white. That world is inherited, and it comes before an individual arrives. And before an individual arrives can be taken on different timescales. So it does absolutely mean, like, these things happen before you were born. You know, you're born into a system and you're born at a certain place and time, in a certain family condition. So it really fundamentally predates you as a living being. But it also can be much more on a micro timescale, like before we arrive in the room is set up. Before we arrive in the university has its structures. Before we, you know, if we're going to move rooms, if we're going to move universities, we enter into these big structures. So I'm going to be talking about whiteness quite a bit and kind of focusing on that because of the this because of this whiteness of the world. Sorry, this is Sarah Ahmed. Because of this whiteness of the world, which is of the university, of the room, of the situation, and of the global or the international. We could certainly say of the international, right? The international framework, which is the one that's shown on the maps where countries are shown, is based fundamentally on a concept of the nation state, which is European in creation, and which is then imposed on the earth, or mapped onto the earth, in such a way that it becomes almost common sense, in some cases, in some contexts, that for a people to exist means to have a nation state. And if you don't have a nation state, you're not a people. There's no other legitimate polity. You know, the United Nations is not sovereign. It's rather, you know, it has its assembly, then it has its other kind of security thing, and NATO and all these different things. That is a certain mapping of the earth. It's not necessarily the story of the planet. So that's very important to kind of broaden from certain approaches to whiteness, which are individualizing, and too much limiting it to certain things. Like, whiteness has to do with embodiment, it has to do with skin color, it has to do with family relations, but it's those things are within very large systems, which include everything that I've been gesturing towards as the planetary. And so when we think about like the whiteness of a room or our own relation to whiteness, which, you know, so one thing I'm not gonna be doing is sort of relying upon, well, I'll get to this in much more detail, but one thing I'm not gonna be doing is relying upon an individualizing definition of whiteness such that you have to clarify whether you're white or not in order to begin doing anything. I won't be doing that because I think whiteness is a much larger system. And I think we want to think through probably our relations to whiteness, but what we could say is like, in a UK university, we are already working through our systems of whiteness. Like, everyone has a relation to whiteness regardless of how you identify personally in relation to whiteness. So to think through it doesn't mean necessarily a limited kind of identification. And indeed, that is where practice research and artistic research have something really profound to contribute. So as a bridge to that, I'm going to include a final quote here. Ceremonies carry potential for transformation. That is to say, what we do has the possibility to change the way things are. However, ceremonies as constructed events for indigenous and black people as New World subjects are different from those for conquistador subjects. This is written from a North American perspective very explicitly. It's by Tiffany Letabo King, whose work is really central for my thinking. And she's saying conquistador in part to problematize exactly this individualizing of whiteness in North America, because nobody in North America, I think, currently identifies as a conquistador. But it is to bring that historical relation and to make this kind of historical framework, again, like, what is the story of the planet? What is the story of the land we are on? Where someone might say, oh yes, I am white, of course, but once you kind of say, oh, by that do you mean conquistador subjectivity? You know, it's opening up a kind of a different historical narrative. But what I want to take from this is, first of all, ceremonies can carry potential for transformation. So what we do can change the way things are. And I think, to me, that's the starting point for thinking about practice research and artistic research. I think ceremony is a very powerful way to think about all modes of artistic research and practice research. But then, this book, The Black Shoals, is specifically about black and indigenous relationality in North America. And so it very much leaves to the reader, if the reader is in any way operating in white institutionality or white networks at any level, to kind of say, oh, okay, so what would those ceremonies be then in a, let's say, a UK university that would have the potential for transformation? So now I'll briefly do a kind of acknowledgement. I think acknowledgement is, first of all, a first step of any kind of telling of a planetary story. It's also a kind of ceremony. It could be a ceremony that has the potential to transform. I won't make any big claims for the transformative potential of this, but we know that we can see that like land acknowledgements as a ceremony are being used in particular ways. They also have many limitations, but what I haven't seen and what I've been asking for the last few years is like, so what would that look like in the UK, specifically in Northern England? So I made one up. It's still a draft. I welcome feedback. And in here, I've very boldly substituted, but in light gray, your own center, because I think at least at this level, there's a lot of similarity. So I've been saying the Center for Experimental Practices is based in Huddersfield in Northern England. One can substitute their own context, of course. And then I've been saying, I would like to start by acknowledging that modern England owes its existence to ongoing extractive and neo-colonial relations around the world. The rights of the peoples colonized by this country to live and work freely here and to participate in the determination of its future remain unceded. And I can share these slides very much, absolutely. So this is, you know, very, very kind of like, I put it out there as a draft. You may want to use it or adapt it or take some part of it or reject it. But certainly it's a reference to the wall, but it's a reference to the wall that takes inspiration from Indigenous land acknowledgements, which tend to say that the right to the land is unceded. So it assumes a kind of historical trajectory or narrative that is very different from the dominant one. And in this case, I assume that there is a right of people colonized by the UK to live and work freely here and to participate in the determination of its future, and that right has not been ceded. Again, rights can be a problematic framework, but that's another conversation. So now, I will go into two like little sets of concepts from this recent book that I published. Of course, I'm not getting into the full argument or details of everything in a book, in a presentation, but I'm like thinking again about like what are the most important conceptual tools or entry points or little elements from this book's work that I could offer in a context where we have a few hours together. So the first one is the subtitle of the book and the subtitle of the talk, which is The Relations of Technique, Identity, and Place. I guess I would say this is how I am currently conceptualizing a framework within which we could activate practice research or artistic research in conversation with this emergent planetary context or narrative. The reason, so identity obviously is present, and that means racial identity, gender identity, but it also means all of the, you know, I think looking at the global map, it's very, and the global wall, we're talking very much about like passports that people hold, citizenship status, language, as well as all the other identity markers. I don't really want to say markers. I think this framework takes identity as something very substantive, but not necessarily individual. And what it's about is about the relations between identity and place, but also identity and technique. I'm not gonna super go into why I'm using the term technique, although I could. I mean, my first book that came out like almost 10 years ago was about technique, and it was about technique as knowledge. So you could say knowledge, identity, and place. For me, knowledge is still very much bound to writing and logocentrism, and that's what I will address on the next slide, so that's why I'm not really saying knowledge. I'm saying technique. This comes again from performing arts practice research and wanting to say, what is the knowledge that we are working with here? It certainly is knowledge. I mean, my first book is an argument that technique is knowledge, basically. That's all it is. So it's given me this concept of technique that is very, has a lot of depth. Like technique is not like a set of rules. Technique is a name of fields of knowledge. Fields of knowledge that structure practice. If you think about the received or dominant or hegemonic way in which we relate these, we might relate these three things, technique, identity, and place. I think you'll find that there are a lot of systems or processes or practices in which we have to engage, and I'm still saying kind of like UK universities as a context, or just the UK in general, or just the inside of the global wall. In which what we are asked to do or required to do is to act as if these three things are entirely separate tracks. So for example, you will have your, well, we can think, for example, of a hiring process really simply, that like there's a lot of work, and I'm not saying it's necessarily bad work, but there's a lot of work done to separate technique from identity. And to say, and if you think about any debate over casting in any kind of performing arts, again, a lot of work, this has changed in the casting debates, but like a lot of work to separate technique from identity. So the question of what you do should be like radically delinked from the question of who you are. And there's a lot of pressure to not bring who you are into spaces where the focus is supposed to be on what you do. Another way to say that is your professional identity, like what you teach or what discipline you work in, the role that you're paid for, your kind of position in the university or institution in general, should be more or less radically severed from your gender, your racial identification, your languages, your citizenship status, your disability status, your kinship networks. All of that is kind of like, do not bring that into the room. Again, I'm not saying that all that work is wrong. I think there's a certain mode of reparative, there's a kind of reparative attempt that has been worked through that separation. But it's not a planetary story, I guess, is what I would say. Like, if you're assuming that you're in the UK, that the border walls are all strong, and that this kind of extractive relation is ongoing, then if you think of, let's say, people of the global majority, that concept, if you think of that as minorities, then you can get some kind of traction with, like, you know, we need to separate technique from identity. Because racialized and otherwise marginalized gender and other kinds of identities are understood as baggage or problems, and so, you know, they can hold people back in a certain kind of context. And so then you kind of empower people by separating, like, oh no, you can do knowledge and technique, you know, without your identity. It's just like, don't worry about that. But if we want a planetary story, that's not going to work at all. So the main argument of this book is that technique is made of identity, and identity is made of technique. And also that identity is made of place, and the place is made of identity. This is a kind of bold theoretical claim, and I don't think I'm going to really fully unpack it. I'm more going to move on to some of its implications. But what I am kind of suggesting is that there is a strong, material, but not determinative relationship between technique, identity, and place. And one of the things I do in the book that is probably the chapter that is, like, I would say most effective, or the one that people have most, it's not even a chapter, it's a sub-chapter, it's like a little section where people have most kind of been like, oh, that's really helpful, is one that says, it critiques two books. I won't go into what they are, but sort of one book would argue, or one book sets up technique as if it is really free from identity, and it's this like plane of kind of, freedom and possibility, and like, oh, identity can just dissolve into technique because identity is made of technique, right? So you could say like, oh, well, you know, we don't need these kind of hard like gender and racial and class and all these different, you know, identities that we're carrying, because actually they're all made of technique. They're all made of bits and pieces of things that people do. I mean, this is an argument that is very strong in queer theory and trans theory for very good reasons. But if it goes too far in that direction, it actually kind of dissolves identity into technique. And so what you get is that identity is made of technique, and therefore we don't really need to talk about identity. We can just talk about technique. And then the other book I critique is the opposite, where it kind of locks technique and identity together to the extent, and this is a book not only of critical race theory and not only of Black studies, but of Afro-pessimism. So it's kind of a very rigorous, trenchant argument that technique is, in the current world at least, in any world we can really imagine, almost helpless in the face of identity. Like, it can't really do anything. Because the layers of identity, and this book is not talking about gender, this book is only talking about race, and in a very kind of structuralist way of talking about race. those identities are so deeply sedimented and material that pretty much anything we do at the level of technique is just like rearranging the deck chairs of a sinking ship, right? It's not really, which I frame in the book as an argument against artistic research and practice research, basically, because if you think that what we do in art and practice and artistic practice is made of identity, but you don't think that identity is made of technique, what you're saying is, I mean, why do anything at the level of technique? Why do, you know, what there's no, you kind of evacuate the context of artistic experiments because they don't have any effect on identity, and they certainly won't have any effect on place, which is even more deeply sedimented. So it kind of is an, it's, he doesn't mean it this, I mean, he doesn't say this, but because he doesn't talk about artistic research, but it's an argument against artistic research, against practice research, almost an argument against research, right? Almost an argument like anything that we frame on a technical level, that's why it's called pessimism, right? Because it's not really, nothing is really possible because there is no traffic, except that there's the up arrow. Like, technique is made of identity, so what you do will be expressive of your identity. So any work that you make will be expressive of your, essentially your racial positioning. Whiteness, blackness, and indigeneity are the only ones that Frank Wilderson cares about. So whatever you do will be expressive of those positions, but it will not change the positions. You will not unmake blackness or whiteness or indigeneity or rearrange their relations or transform them in any way through anything that would be merely expressive. So that's the argument of this book. It's not only that technique, identity, and place are, well, yeah, no, the argument of the book is that technique, identity, and place are made of each other, maybe at different levels of sedimentation, but also thereby that artistic research and practice research have a very important role to play in remaking the planetary story. Because if you think that identity is made of technique and that place is ultimately made of identity and technique, then it's actually very important, the experiments that we undertake at the level of technique. But it's very essential that we think our technique in relation to our identities and our places, right? But not in the sense that our emplacement and our embodiment and our identity determine our technique, essentially making our technique useless or without any capacity to change anything. That's not what it means. The arrows go in both directions. So we have to think our technique in relation to our identities and our places in this way that they go in both directions. How is the technique that we have to think, how is the technique that we're working with structured by and made up of, in fact, our identities and the places that we are from. But we can all, once we do that, I think then we have the possibility to also think about how the techniques that we're working with have the potential to change our own identities and identities in general, and maybe even the planetary story. So I have one more step. This is kind of the, yeah, I mean, I think, so that's maybe the first half, and I hope that some of what I've said is useful in the sense, like, I think I've introduced race, technique, identity, and place in relation to artistic research. I haven't said that much about the forms of knowledge. So now I'll shift into that, and that goes more directly into artistic research and practice research. So I'm going to offer two concepts, also from the book. If you want more on them, they're in the book, and, you know, lots of, I'd love to talk more about them. Two concepts in relation to each other, which, yeah, this is the first talk where I've foregrounded these two concepts, so I'd love to hear feedback on, like, how useful they are. No, there is one other talk where I introduced this first concept, which is the concept of white writing, and there was a kind of reaction of, like, oh, I needed that tool. You know, I've been looking for it, and I didn't have it. And thank you. So, I'm curious to hear whether this is useful. So, white writing is, first of all, a thing that combines technique and identity. So, in such a way that, right, it's not possible to think that technique and identity are completely separate, as I was referring to before. Right, if you think that writing is this field of knowledge which is universal and anyone can access it, and, you know, in the language of, academia, could be considered like colorblind. That's quote unquote colorblind. Like, right, it doesn't have anything to do with identity. Whereas identity is blah blah blah, whatever you think identity is, you can't have a concept of white writing. White writing is a concept that talks about how, and again, so going back to what I said, technique is made of identity, and identity is made of technique. What that would mean here is that whiteness is in part constructed out of the technology of writing. So it means that gives us a whole bunch of tools for looking at writing and for looking at whiteness. So if we want to look at whiteness, instead of only looking at skin color or even only looking at like citizenship or wealth or something like that, we could also open up a whole set of questions about how writing is being used as a technology. By the same token, anytime that someone is then talking about writing, or as someone already alluded to today, requiring certain types of writing from you, one can immediately ask to what extent that writing is made out of whiteness and is constructing whiteness. So I think it's quite a powerful tool. I think it's a thing where, I mean, at least for me, and at least for, yeah, at least for me, once you start to look for white writing, it's very, very present and it's very powerful. Just to give a few examples, well, let's go back to the nation state. It is currently, in the current scheme of the planet, impossible to imagine a nation state without a set of founding written documents. They must be written. You cannot have a nation state that is founded on a painting. You cannot have a nation state that is founded on a video. But you can't even have a nation state that's founded on a poem, right? It has to be a certain kind of writing. Similarly, you can't have a university or any kind of organization or institution that is not founded on a certain kind of writing. Again, you can't have a university and be like, the university is founded, this is our poem. And
not yet.
Not yet, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
Indigenous
rights lawyers, they're using dance, song to actually support indigenous peoples in terms of land rights.
Yeah. That is what this is coming from. And I'm merely applying to our local context. So how do we do that? I don't need to say more. That's very clear then, white writing. What I'm offering, and this term I'm less sure about, so you know, I would love to have a conversation about it, especially if you think it's not the right term. But what I'm offering in response to white writing is something that I started calling critical whiteness practice. Critical whiteness practice is, the term is coming from critical whiteness studies, which particularly in the US, but also elsewhere, there's this field, or has been a field of critical whiteness studies, which attempts to study whiteness in the ways that I have talked about. So not as, not psychological, certainly not biological, but as a social structure, as a structure coming out of capitalism and colonialism, and to ask, okay, how was this made? What forms of art, what forms of writing, what forms of weapons, what forms of fences, have been used to construct whiteness. And there's some great work in critical whiteness studies. I would actually probably say that the Sarah Ahmed quote from before is certainly in the field of critical whiteness studies. And in fact, the other two as well, the Azule and the King, you can definitely situate them in that conversation. And what I've been reflecting on in relation to practice research is something that some folks in critical whiteness studies, there's a Robin Wegman, for example, has pointed to the way in which there's this kind of, it's quite a problem in critical whiteness studies, because while you can develop this critical approach to whiteness, the methodological approach to whiteness can still be quite white, in fact. So for example, any attempt to fully know and catalog and taxonomize what is whiteness, like this is what Robin Wegman invokes, is kind of like, we're gonna get it, you know, we're gonna know whiteness, we're gonna absolutely catalog and we're gonna say it's this and this and this and this, and then through this like great understanding, which might be quantitative or qualitative, but certainly it's grounded in social sciences, like then we're gonna know it, And that's going to allow us to change it or dismantle it or fragment it or deconstruct it or whatever we want to do. But that way of knowing is not necessarily the only one or the one that we need in that context, particularly if you're talking about people who are at least working in massively predominantly white institutions and universities in countries of the global north, in Europe and North America, basically, who are, you know, grappling with whiteness, and it's like, okay, we're gonna get it, but what is, how does that radically transform the whole research process? That question isn't really answered. And I'm starting to think that actually it's quite fruitful to reframe a large amount, a really large amount of practice research and artistic research and what's called research creation in Canada as critical whiteness practice. What I mean by that is there's a lot of work happening in practice research and artistic research which engages with things that are certainly very important, like ecology, like in the climate crisis, like disability, like gender, all of the kind of key materiality, new materialisms, like things that are really central to how we've theorized practice research, or how practice research has been theorized, which are not talking about race very much and not really engaging with that planetary story. And here are two things that I don't think we should do. I don't think we should say, but that's because they're engaging with ecology and disability and queerness, so that they don't have to look at race. They don't have to look at the planetary story because they're working on those things. Because to do that is to universalize the whiteness of those approaches to ecology and disability and queerness and these kinds of things. And to kind of say, like, look, we'll do this work on, let's say, ecology. This is one, you know, we'll do this work of sort of like, we're going to go out into nature and have these other relationships with nature, which may or may not, well, I won't say may or may not, which are more or less inspired by and in debt to indigenous knowledges and relations to Earth. We're going to go do that, and in that way, we're researching environmental relations or human and nature relations, right? And then that's going to be sort of like basically framed as universal research for the whole, everybody on the planet, like research for the planet. Like we're going to solve the climate crisis in that way, or we're going to contribute to the solving of the climate crisis in that way. And that's too grand. That's much too grand, I think, for what those practices are doing. But equally, I don't think we should throw those practices out and say, they're not really doing anything. And this is, I'm echoing the technique identity relation, right? That is, throw them out and say, like, you think you are going out and developing new relationships to natural environments, but it's merely all held within this whiteness, this white institutional context, or the whiteness of the way you're doing it, or whatever the whiteness is. It's all kind of contained within that. So you're really not developing anything that's a new relationship to nature or to the body. I don't think we should do that either. I don't think we can afford to do that. I think the contributions of that kind of practice research and artistic research, which are ethically grounded, are in fact a significant contribution, but they are a significant contribution in the sense that they are critical and potentially transformative of whiteness. And in particular, they are responses to white writing. And white writing, to go back to that, can be a very broad term. I mean, certainly, as I mentioned, it includes institutional documents. It will include your module specs and your module evaluations. But it's any mode in which writing attempts to dominate or fully know and taxonomize life and the world. So it also includes, for example, the history of Western classical music notation. So this is an example that I've been kind of working in relation to a little bit, where when I see experiments in Western classical musical notation, and substitute your own Eurocentric lineage, whatever it is, when I see experiments being done in relation to the Eurocentric lineage of knowledge forms, I keep feeling every time it's becoming a little bit like, which is why it now makes it into the center of the presentation. It's like I keep feeling like, great, like of course you need to break down and transform this notation, this form of writing. That's desperately needed, but it only can be a contribution to the planetary story if it's framed in relation to the whiteness to a provincialization of the whiteness of those forms of knowledge. So if you say, if you recognize classical Western music notation or classical approaches to visual art or classical, I mean, theater script, right? Okay, let me speak more closely to my own training. So this is a question that's actually been coming up across performing arts. I think it will be visual arts as well. What were the 70s in this way of the global North 70s? Like, what was happening there? If you frame it as a planetary liberation, then that's not going to be able to really contribute to a planetary story because it is way too universalizing and it has not incorporated any of the conversations about race and decoloniality. But if you throw it out as like merely some hippies, that you're losing a lot. So I think we should be looking at those lineages, which are the lineages that disrupted Western musical notation, disrupted the theatrical form of the script, the scriptwriter, the playwright, the film script, disrupted all of these kind of Western, modern, colonial art forms. If we look, like, what have these decades been in which those have been deconstructed? We can't possibly think that those acts of deconstruction are like a planetary liberation. But they are really rigorous, deep, profound practice research against or with in relation to white writing. They are deconstructions of white writing. They are maybe transformations, fragmentations. They are responses. They are very much grappling with white writing, with whiteness in the form of writing. And so that's how I'm trying to bring a critique of whiteness into the broader conversation about artistic research and practice research, is to say artistic research and practice research as they've developed in, let's say, you know, particularly in Europe, I mean, artistic research in all of these conservatories in Europe, and then practice research in the UK, research creation in Canada, they can be radical potential interventions and contributions to a planetary story if they are understood as critiques of and deconstructions of whiteness. If they are not framed in that way, then they are left to be universalized, which thereby ignores radically other sources of knowledge, such as what you're just alluding to, indigenous sources of knowledge, and all the sort of worlds from which so many of those people who have deconstructed whiteness were drawing on, like all kinds of, what, you know, indigenous forms of performance, or what was also then called traditional forms of performance, like all of those tools, all of those things, what is the relation to those that it's not extractive or it's not appropriation? So again, if you take those and you're like, I have liberated theater by drawing on global performance forms, then you are appropriating those to do that. But if you take them and you say, I am working within this power, this context of hegemonic whiteness in which theater is understood to be only possible through the existence of a script and a director and a casting process, and oh my goodness, yes, can I learn from or put myself in apprenticeship to some other totally different ways of being in the world that have been marginalized and repressed, I'm going to use those, but I'm not going to use those in a way that brings them back and tries to say, like, and now this is the planetary solution. I'm going to use them in a way that says, this is what I can do to deconstruct the way that theater or art or music is constructed in my context. So, I felt like I wanted to give a lot of a kind of a theoretical context. I haven't really touched on my own artistic research practice, but I think I will just briefly. So I have been making video work for a number of years, coming out of performing arts into video work. And just to introduce three works, so on the top left is Diaspora, which is published in a scholarly journal, so it went through a peer review process. And it's a certain kind of intervention to say my article is a video. The video is collaboratively made. I appear in the video, but I also edit the video. There's all kinds of formal technical details, and this is, you know, my own practice. So I'm coming down into that, but I think I want to show how I've applied some of that thinking. That is a formal intervention into the context of a scholarly journal. The one on the top right was actually presented in an eco-performance festival online. But what's important about it in this context is that it's not by me. I'm not the main author, although the video materials come from a project that I led. So it's my colleague Edda Edchin who has edited and created this video, again collaborative, using shared materials. This is actually the kind of, like a starting point for the kind of experiment, practical experiment that I prepared for us if we want to do stuff together in a kind of practical way. And the bottom is my Instagram experiment, which you can find it at Crypto Judaica. All of these are attempts to interact with particular forms of knowledge, like particularly the academic journal article, to say like this journal article is a collaboratively generated video, right? This theater performance is a collaboratively edited video article, or this Instagram is an experiment at relating text and video in different ways. And the theoretical context that I was offering before has evolved out of my questions about like what is going on here in these videos. So like when I see myself, when I put text on myself, when I put text on someone else, those are my mom's hands in this video. So when I see my mom on the screen over there, when I see a dead pigeon over here, and when the video is in a certain place. And there is something for me about the video context in relation to practice research that has, I think, required me or been made possible by this thinking about technique, identity, and place. Because for one thing, the research here is really initially framed as being about song. But one of the things about video is that you can't really get song on video without body and identity, right? So if you think of a song as a written piece of musical notation, in a mode of white writing of European classical music notation, that is intentionally, specifically, rigorously, very powerfully divorced from the body and identity of the person who is singing it, let alone, the person who composed it, let alone the person who's singing it. Video is a different kind of situation. I've been super interested in how technique, identity, and place are all present in the video. Like, the song is there, but so are the people and the place. The place is also really palpable, but not necessarily on its own. Like, you also need text to explain what is the technique, what is the identity, what is the place, and how are these things related. I didn't want to foreground my own research too much because I think, you know, as I work with video more and more, and I look at video art, and I look at the history of videographic anthropology, and I look at videographic film criticism, other fields that I work with video in academia and outside academia, I see that, it's so important not to claim the form of knowledge as a larger or broader solution than it really is. I think these are quite interesting interventions in their situations. And in some ways, they could be framed as more or less interventions into whiteness, although I don't only frame them. I mean, I primarily frame them in relation to whiteness and Jewishness in a way that is theoretically framed by critical Black and Indigenous studies. That's kind of the theoretical framework around them. I think that, for example, the form of a journal article or the form of a journal is a really interesting pressure point, as is the form of a PhD. Very similar, like what is a PhD? Well, again, there's a very dominant form of white writing that we all know and wrestle with in different ways of like, this is what a PhD is. And when you say it's not what a PhD is, again, it certainly is not a universal liberation, because it only makes sense if you start from that idea of what a PhD is, right? But if you are operating in a massive institutional context, which is, you know, has unbelievable power on a planetary scale, which assumes that it knows what a PhD is, then actually if you contest the form of a PhD, it can can be a really, really important, meaningful contribution without being a universal liberation. I have a couple of video works that I thought I might show, but I think I probably won't. This one's not online, but the other one is. But I guess I wanted to evoke them because this one is more, this one is the Human Ceremony, which is specifically in conversation with Tiffany Letsabo King. It is an attempt to activate or begin to contribute to a possibility of decolonial Jewishness. This one is more explicitly about whiteness. It's called Whiteness. Again, it's published. This one is in a journal. It's in Performance Philosophy, so you, and it's open access. So you can go watch it if you want. But it puts text on top of bodies in order to grapple with whiteness without, it certainly doesn't kind of name the people in the video as white or not white. It tries not to be reductive in its naming of what's happening while opening up meaningful questions about what is happening. So I have one more thing to touch on. I also want to talk about the journal that I edit, because I edited and founded a journal, which is a journal of videos. So it's just another level of the same question of like, what is a journal article? What is a journal, in fact? Which is, so now I'm really in the forms of knowledge, right? What is a PhD? What is a book? What is a journal article? What is a journal? And I'm saying, yeah, these are really important questions if we can put them in the right planetary frame. This journal we have published, actually we're on 7.1 now, and you know, it's open access, and it again simply asks the question of what a journal article is, if it is on the one hand about embodied research. Sorry, the journal is called Journal of Embodied Research, so obviously the topic is embodied research. I would now say embodied and in-place research, and that is through engagements with anthropology and indigenous studies that I have realized that, and that's the whole addition of place, because I think my work has been basically on the relation between technique and identity, and now I understand that it's essential to include place, but that is where I'm at currently, so it's not as thought through. That's why it's also called embodied research rather than embodied and in-place research. But if the topic is embodied research, but if the form is videographic, what does that mean? So how does the body appear? How does emplacement appear? And you see, it's, you know, there are many different ways of approaching that. Embodiment might appear through mounting a GoPro, which then you don't see the body, but you experience the body through its movement. This is a film project, so it's cinematically lit and has a whole other thing going on. This one is Annette Arlander, who you might know. And it's durational, as you can see. There are four screens within the screen. Her work is a massively important contribution to artistic research. The body is present, but only in relation to the landscape, but also on time scales that are very significant, like having been going to a certain spot on an island for 5 years or 10 years or 15 years. It tries to bring that durational quality in. And a couple more. So, these are two contexts, my own artistic research and the Journal of Embodied Research, in which I'm using video, well, not just video, but, well, yeah, using videographic form as a way to intervene in the academic context in which I find myself. I'm also now more thinking about video outside of academic contexts. But yeah, I think if I can just go back to the relations of technique, identity, and place. I know that everyone is working with different forms of practice research, and I think the invitation is to think through the relations between technique, identity, and place as if those things are in relation to each other, as if they are constructive and constitutive of each other, and really as if they are made up of each other, maybe moving at different speeds or something like that. That they are not separate things. They are not locked apart from each other. Neither are they determinative of each other. To me, that's a very generative way to kind of reframe practice research as a possible contribution to this planetary story. I think that we should take a break, and then we could maybe think about whether we would like to do. So what I have in the practice, I'll just tell you what it is so you can think about it. I mean, it's structured as 90 minutes. It doesn't have to be that long. But basically, the reason I call it an experiment is I have developed quite a strong method in relation to my own artistic research videos, but it's very much based in performing arts. So like if we were all in music, dance, and theater, I would say let's do the method. But I want to open it up in a more interdisciplinary way, so that I have a little bit of an experiment that makes that method a little more porous. So we could do that when we come back.
That's a wonderful plan. Thank you very much.